probably wipe if he could. "How do you feel?" I ask. "How do I look?" "Pretty good, considering." He manages to smile. When he tries to peer down at himself, though, I realize he has no idea how he looks. He's just together enough to know he shouldn't trust his senses. "Anyone else come to see you?" I ask. It takes him a while to answer. "Not Gil, if that's what you mean." "I mean anyone." "Maybe you missed my mom out there." Charlie smiles and repeats himself without noticing. "She's easy to miss." I look out the doorway again. Mrs. Freeman is still talking to the doctor. "Don't worry," Charlie says, misunderstanding. "He'll come." But by now, the nurse has called everyone who might care that Charlie's conscious again. If Gil isn't here already, he's not coming. "Hey," Charlie says, changing the subject. "You okay with what happened back there?"
"When?"
"You know, what Taft said." I try to call up the words. We were at the Institute hours ago. It's probably the last thing he remembers.
"About your dad."
Charlie tries to reposition himself and winces. I stare at the railing, suddenly pinned. Mrs. Freeman has bullied the doctor enough that he finally leads her into a private room to confer. The two of them disappear behind a distant door, and now the hallway's empty.
"Look," Charlie says faintly, "don't let someone like that mess with your head."
This is what Charlie does on death's door. He thinks about my problems. "I'm glad you're okay," I tell him. I know he's about to say something smart when he feels the pressure I'm putting on his hand and keeps it simple.
"Me too."
Charlie smiles at me again, then laughs.
"I'll be damned," he says,
and shakes his head. His eyes are focused on something beyond me.
"I'll be damned," he says again.
He's fading, I think. But when I turn around, Gil is standing in the doorway, a bouquet of flowers in hand. "I stole these from the ball arrangements," he says hesitantly, as if he's not sure he's welcome here.
"You better like them." "No wine?"
Charlie's voice is faint. Gil gives an awkward smile. "Only the cheap stuff for you." He walks forward and extends a hand to Charlie. "The nurse told me we've got 2 minutes," Gil offers. "How are you feeling?"
"Been better," Charlie says. "Been worse."
"I think your mom's here," Gil replies, still searching for a way to begin. Charlie starting to drift, but manages another smile.
"She's easy to miss."
"You're not going to check out on us tonight, are you?" Gil asks quietly.
"Out of the hospital?"
Charlie says, too far away now to know how the question was meant. "Yeah."
"Maybe," Charlie whispers. "The food in here," he exhales, "is terrible."
His head falls back onto the pillow just as the leather-faced nurse returns to say our time is up, that Charlie needs his rest. "Sleep tight, Chief," Gil says, putting the bouquet on the nightstand. Charlie doesn't hear him. He's already breathing through his mouth. As we leave, I look back at him, propped up in his bed, swaddled in bandages and guarded by IVs. It reminds me of comic books I used to read as a kid. The fallen giant that medicine rebuilt. The mysterious patient's recovery that amazed local doctors. Darkness falls on Gotham, but the headlines are all the same. Today, a superhero wrestled with a force of nature and lived to complain about the food. "He's going to be okay?" Gil asks when we reach the visitor's parking lot. The Saab is sitting alone in the lot, its hood still warm enough to have melted the falling snow.
"I think so.
His chest looks pretty bad. I don't know what rehab is like for burn victims, but getting used to your own skin again can't be easy.
I didn't think you were going to show up, I tell him.
Gil hesitates. I wish I'd been there with you guys.
When?
All day.
Is that a joke?
He turns to me.
No. What's that supposed to mean?
We stop just short of the car. I realize I'm angry at him. Angry at how hard it was for him to find anything to say to Charlie. Angry at the way he seemed afraid to visit Charlie this afternoon.
You were where you wanted to be, I say.
I came as soon as I heard. You weren't with us.
When? He asks. This morning?
This whole time.
Jesus. Tom, you know why he's in there? I say.
Because he made the wrong decision. Because he tried to help. He didn't want us going into Taft's office alone. He didn't want Paul to get hurt in the tunnels.
What do you want, Tom? An apology? Mea culpa. I can't compete with Charlie. That's the way he is. That's the way he's always been.
That's the way you were. You know what Mrs. Freeman said to me in there? The first thing she brought up? Stealing the clapper out of Nassau Hall.
Gil runs his fingers through his hair.
She blames me for that. She always has. You know why?
Because she thinks Charlie's a saint?
Because she can't believe you're the kind of person who ever would have done something like that.
He exhales.
So what?
You are the kind of person who would have done something like that. You did do it.
He seems unsure what to say.
Does it occur to you that maybe I'd had half a dozen beers that night before I ran into you guys? Maybe I wasn't thinking straight.
Or maybe you were different then.
Yes, Tom. Maybe I was.
Silence falls. The first dimples of snow are forming on the hood of the Saab. Somehow, the words amount to a confession.
Look, he says, I'm sorry.
For what?
I should have gone in to see Charlie the first time when I saw you and Paul.
Forget it.
I'm stubborn. I've always been stubborn.
He emphasizes always, as if to say, look, Tom, some things haven't changed.
But everything has changed. In a week, a day, an hour.
Charlie, then Paul, now, suddenly, Gil.
I don't know, I tell him.
You don't know what?
What you've been doing all this time.
Why everything's different.
Jesus, I don't even know what you're doing next year.
From his hip pocket, Gil produces his key fob and unlocks the doors.
Let's go, he says, before we freeze to death.
We stand in the snow, alone in the hospital parking lot. The sun has nearly slipped off the edge of the sky, introducing darkness, giving everything the texture of ashes.
Get in, he says.
Let's talk.
Chapter 25. That night, I got to know Gil again for the first time, probably also the last. He was almost as charming as I remembered. Funny, interested, smart about the things that mattered, smug about the things that didn't. We drove back to the room, Sinatra playing, conversation somehow never faltering. And before I could even ask what I was going to wear to the ball, I opened the door to my bedroom and found a tuxedo waiting for me on a hanger, pressed and spotless, with a note clipped to the plastic garment bag. Tom, if this doesn't fit, you've shrunk.
Gee.
In the midst of everything else, he'd found time to bring one of my suits to a rental shop and ask for a tux of matching size. My dad thinks I should take some time off, he says, answering my question from before. Travel for a while, Europe, South America.
It's strange to remember someone you've known all along. It isn't like returning to the home you grew up in and noticing how it left its shape on you, how the walls you've raised and the doors you've opened since then have all followed the design you saw for the first time there.
It's closer to returning home and seeing your mother or sister, who are old enough not to have grown since you last saw them, but young enough not to have aged, and realizing for the first time how they look to everyone else. How beautiful they'd be if you didn't know them. What your father and brother-in-law saw when they judged them most and knew them least. Honestly, Gil says, I haven't decided. I'm not sure my dad's one to give advice. The Saab was his idea, and that was a mistake. He was thinking about what he would have wanted at our age. He talks to me like I'm someone else. Gil was right. He's no longer the freshman who let pants fly above Nassau Hall. He's more careful than that, more circumspect. You'd see him and think he was world-wise, self-involved. The natural authority in his speech and his body language is more pronounced now, a quality that Ivy has cultivated. The clothes he wears are quieter by a shade, and his hair, which was always just long enough to be noticed, never seems tousled now. There is a science behind it, because you never notice when it's been cut. He's put on a touch of weight, which makes him handsome in a different way, a hint more staid, and the little affectations he brought from Exeter, the ring he wore on his pinky finger, the stud he wore in his ear, have quietly disappeared. I figure I'll wait until the last minute. I'll decide during graduation. Something spontaneous, something unexpected. Maybe become an architect. Maybe get back into sailing. Here he is, changing into his clothes, taking off his wool pants in front of me, not realizing what a perfect stranger I am. A person this version of himself has never met. I realize I'm probably a stranger to myself, that I've never been able to see the person Katie waited for all night last night, the newest model, the up-to-the-minute me. There's a riddle here somewhere, a paradox. Frogs and wells, and the curious case of Tom Sullivan, who looked in a mirror and saw the past. Man walks into a bar, Gil says, returning to an old standby. Completely naked, and there's a duck sitting on his head. The bartender says, Carl, there's something different about you today. The duck shakes his head and says, Harry, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. I wonder why he chose that joke. Maybe he's been getting at the same point this entire time. We've all been talking to him as if he were someone else. The Saab has been our idea of him, and it was our mistake. Gil himself is something unexpected, something spontaneous. An architect, a sailor, a duck. You know what I was listening to on the radio the other day? He asks. After Anna and I broke up? Sinatra. But I know it's wrong. Samba, he tells me. I was scanning through the stations, and WPRB was playing a Latin set, something instrumental, no voices. Great rhythm, amazing rhythm. WPRB, the campus radio station that played Handel's Messiah when women first arrived at Princeton. I remember Gil on the night I first met him, outside the bell tower at Nassau Hall. He came out of the darkness doing a little rumba thrust, saying, Now shake it, baby. Dance. There's always been music about him, the jazz he's been trying to play on the piano since the day we met. Maybe there's something old about the new after all. I don't miss her, he says, trying for the first time to let me in. She'd put this stuff in her hair, pomade. Her stylist gave it to her. You know how it smells after someone vacuums, sort of hot and clean? Sure. It was like that. She must have blow-dried it until it burned. Every time she'd lean her head on me, I'd think, You smell like my carpet. He's everywhere now, free associating. You know who else smelled like that? He asks. Who? Think back, freshman year. Hot and clean. The fireplace in Rockefeller comes immediately to mind. Lana McKnight, I say. He nods. I never knew how you guys stayed together as long as you did. The chemistry was so strange. Charlie and I used to make bets about when you two would break up. He told me he liked Lana. Remember the girl he dated sophomore year? Gil says, already moving on. Charlie? Her name was Sharon, I think? With the different colored eyes? Now she had great smelling hair. I remember she used to sit in our room waiting for Charlie to get back. The whole room would smell like this lotion my mom used to wear. I've never known what it was, but I always loved it. It occurs to me that Gil has only mentioned stepmothers to me before, never his real mother. The affection gives him away. You know why they broke up? He says. Because she dumped him. Gil shakes his head. Because he got tired of picking up after her. She'd leave things in our room, sweaters, purses, anything, and Charlie'd have to bring them back. He didn't realize it was just a move. She was giving him a reason to visit her at night. Charlie just thought she was a slob. I struggle with my tie, trying to knot it between the fangs of the collar. Good old Charlie. Cleanliness next to godliness. She didn't break up with him, Gil continues. The girls who fall for Charlie never do. He always breaks up with them. There's a slight suggestion in his voice that this is a fact about Charlie worth bearing in mind, an important character trait, this fault-finding. As if it helps to explain the problems Gil has had with him. He's a good guy, Gil says, catching himself. He seems content to leave it at that. For a second, there's no sound in the room but the friction of fabric against fabric as I pull off the black tie and begin again. Gil sits down on his mattress and runs his fingers through his hair. He got into that habit back when his hair was longer. His hands still haven't adapted to the change. At last I manage a knot, a sort of walnut with wings. I look in the mirror and decide it's good enough. I slip on my jacket. A perfect fit, even better than my own suit. Gil is still silent, watching himself in the mirror, as if his image were a painting. Here we are, at the end of his presidency, his Ivy farewell. Tomorrow the club will be run by next year's officers, the members he created at Bicker, and Gil will become a ghost in his own house. The best of the Princeton he knew is coming to an end. Hey, I say, walking across the foyer into his bedroom, try to have a good time tonight. He doesn't seem to hear me. He places his cell phone on its charger, watching the light pulse. I wish this wasn't the way things turned out, he says. Charlie'll be okay, I tell him. But he just eyes his jewelry case, the tiny wooden chest where he keeps his valuables, and runs his palm across the top, brushing off the dust. Everything in Charlie's half of the room is old but spotless. A pair of athletic shoes from freshman year sits at the edge of the closet, laces tucked in. Last year's pair is still being broken in on weekends. But everything in Gil's half of the room seems unlived in, new and dusty at the same time. From inside the box, he lifts a silver watch, the one he wears on special occasions. Its hands have stopped moving, so he shakes the casing gently, winding it. What time you got? He says. I show him the face of my watch, and he sets his to match. Outside, night has risen. Gil takes his key ring in his hand, then the phone from its charger. My dad's favorite day of college was the Ivy Ball his senior year, he says. He always used to talk about it. I think of Richard Curry, of the stories he told Paul about Ivy. He said it was like living a dream, a perfect dream. Gil places the watch to his ear. He listens to it as if there's something miraculous about the sound, an ocean trapped in a seashell. Ready? He says, pulling the band around his wrist and fastening the metal. He focuses on me now, checking the cut of the tux. Not bad, he says. I think she'll approve. You okay? I ask. Gil adjusts his jacket and nods. I don't think I'll be telling my kids about tonight, but yeah, I'm fine. At the door, we both take one last look before locking up. With the lights out, the room comes to shadows. When I look out the window at the moon one last time, I see Paul in the reflection of my mind's eye, trudging across campus in his worn winter coat, alone. Gil looks at his watch and says, "We should be just on time." Then he and I, in our black suits and black shoes, head out to the Saab in the shoals of the night-colored snow. A costume ball, Gil had told me. And a costume ball it was. We arrived to find the club magnificent, the center of all attention on Prospect Avenue. Tall berms of snow rise like ramparts along the brick wall that surrounds the club, but the path leading to the front door has been cleared, and the walkway has been covered with a thin layer of black stones. Like rock salt, they melt a swath through the ice. Mirroring the effect are four long cloths draped down the front bays of the clubhouse, each one with a vertical stripe of ivy green flanked by thin pillars of gold. As Gil parks the Saab in his space, club members and the few other invitees are approaching Ivy arc-style, in twos, each entrance staggered from the next in polite intervals, careful not to intrude on one another. Seniors arrive last because warm receptions are customary for graduating members, Gil tells me as he shuts off the headlights. We cross the threshold to find the club bustling. The air is heavy with the heat of bodies, the sweet odor of alcohol and cooked food, the slurring conversations that form and reform across the floor. Gil's entrance is met with clapping and cheers. Sophomores and juniors stationed across the first floor turn toward the door to welcome him, some crying Gil's name aloud, and it seems for a second that this could still be the night he hoped for, a night like his father had. "Well," he says to me, ignoring the applause when it continues too long, "this is it." I look around at the club's transformation. The work Gil's been doing, the errands and planning and conversations with florists and caterers, is suddenly more than just an excuse to leave our room when things aren't well. Everything is different. The armchairs and tables that were once here are gone. In their place, the corners of the front hall have been rounded by quarter-circle tables, all hung with silky cloths in regal dark green, and decked in china platters trembling with food. Behind each one, as behind the wet bar to our right, stands an attendant in white gloves. Flower arrangements are everywhere, not a speck of color in any of them, just white lilies and black orchids, and varieties I've never seen before. In the storm of tuxedos and black evening gowns, it's even possible to overlook the brown oak of the walls. "Sir," says a waiter dressed in white tie who has appeared from nowhere bearing a tray of canapés and truffles. "Lamb," he says, pointing at the first, "and white chocolate," pointing at the second. "Have one," Gil says. "So I do, and all the hunger of the day, the missed meals and hospital food fantasies, all of it instantly returns. When another man circles by with a tray of champagne flutes, I help myself again. The bubbles rise straight to my head, helping to keep my thoughts from drifting back to Paul." Just then, a musical quartet kicks up from the dining room antechamber, a place where weathered lounge chairs used to stand. A piano and drum set have been tucked into the corner, with enough room for a bass and electric guitar in between. For the time being, it's R&B standards. Later, I know if Gil has his way, there'll be jazz. "I'll be right back," he says, and suddenly he leaves my side, heading up the stairs. At every step, a member stops him to say something kind, to smile and shake his hand, sometimes to hug him. I see Donald Morgan place a careful hand on Gil's back as he passes, the easy, sincere congratulations of the man who would be king. Junior women, already in their drinks, look at Gil with foggy eyes, sentimental about the club's loss, their loss. He's tonight's hero, I realize, the host and guest of honor both. Everywhere he goes, he'll have company. But somehow, without anyone by his side, Brooks or Anna or one of us, he looks alone already. "Tom," comes a voice from behind me. I turn and the air converges in a single fragrance, the one Gil's mother and Charlie's girlfriend must have worn because it has the same effect on me. If I imagined that I liked Katie best when I saw her with flaws, with her hair up and her shirt untucked, then I was a fool. Because here she is now, tucked into a black gown, hair down, all collarbones and breasts, and I am undone. Wow! She puts a hand on my lapel and rubs off a flake of dust that turns out to be snow, still lingering in this heat. Same to you, she says. There's something wonderful in her voice, a welcome ease. Where's Gil? She asks. Upstairs. She pulls two more flutes of champagne from a passing tray. She is, she says, giving me one. So, who are you supposed to be? I hesitate, unsure what she means. Your costume, who'd you come as? Now Gil reappears. Hey, Katie says, long time no see. Gil sizes the two of us up, then smiles like a proud father. You both look beautiful. Katie laughs. So who are you supposed to be? She asks. With a flourish, Gil swings back the side of his jacket. Only now do I see what he went upstairs to get. There, hanging between the left flank of his waist and his right hip, is a black leather belt. On the belt is a leather holster, and in the holster is an ivory-handled pistol. Aaron Burr, he says, class of 1772. Flashy, Katie says, watching the pearly butt of the gun. What's that? I blurt. Gil seems taken aback. My costume. Burr shot Hamilton in a duel. He puts an arm at my back and leads me toward the landing between the first and second floors. See the lapel pins Jamie Ness is wearing? He points at a blonde senior whose bow tie is embroidered with treble and bass clefs. On the left lapel, I can make out a brown oval. On the right, a black dot. That's a football, Gil says, and that's a hockey puck. He's Hobie Baker, Ivy section of 1914, the only man ever inducted into both the football and hockey halls of fame. Hobie was in a singing group here. That's why Jamie's tie has notes on it. Now Gil points to a tall senior with bright red hair. Chris Bentham, right beside Doug. James Madison, class of 1771. You can tell by the shirt buttons. The top one is a Princeton seal. Madison was the first president of the Alumni Association. And the fourth one is an American flag. There's something mechanical in his voice, a tour guide's inflection, as if he's reading a script in his head. Just make up a costume, Katie interjects, joining our conversation from the foot of the stairs. I glance down at her, and the leverage gives me a new appreciation for the way she fits into her dress. Oh, listen, Gil says, looking past her. I've got to go deal with something. Can you two manage on your own for a second? Over by the wet bar, Brooks is pointing to one of the white-gloved attendants who's leaning heavily against the wall. One of the servers is drunk, Gil says. No rush, I tell him, noticing how Katie's neck looks impossibly thin from this height, like the stem of a sunflower. If you need anything, he says, just let me know. Side by side, we begin to descend. The band is playing Duke Ellington, the champagne flutes are clinking, and Katie's lipstick has a high red gloss, the color of a kiss. Want to dance? I say when I step down from the landing. Katie smiles and takes me by the hand. Listen, rails a-thrumming on the A-train. At the foot of the stairs, Gil's tracks and mine diverge. Chapter 26. The dance floor is 10 degrees hotter than the rest of the club. Couples press tight into each other, merging and turning, an asteroid belt of slow dancers, but I instantly feel comfortable. Katie and I have moved to a lot of music since that first night we met at Ivy. Each weekend on Prospect Avenue, The clubs hire bands to suit every taste, and in just a few months we've tried ballroom and Latin and every style in between. With 9 years of tap behind her, Katie has enough elegance and grace for 3 or 4 dancers, which means that between us, we average about as much as the next couple. Still, as her charity case, I've come a long way. We get bolder the longer we're at it, succumbing to the champagne. I managed to dip her once without falling on top of her. She manages to spin from my good arm once without dislocating anything, and soon we're dangerous on the floor. "I've decided who I am," I tell her, pulling her back toward me. There's a wonderful contact between us, her cleavage tightening, breasts buoyant. "Who?" she says. We're both breathing hard. Tiny drops of sweat are forming at the top of her forehead. "F. Scott Fitzgerald." Katie shakes her head and smiles. Her tongue flits in the gap between her teeth. "You can't," she says. "Scott Fitzgerald's not allowed." We're both talking loudly, our mouths closer and closer to each other's ears in order to hear above the music. "Why not?" I ask, getting my lips tangled in a few strands of hair. She has a dot of perfume on her neck, the same way she did in the darkroom, and the continuum between there and here, the idea that we really are the same people, just differently dressed, is enough. "Because he was a member of Cottage," she says, leaning forward. "That's blasphemy." I smile. "So how long does this keep up? The ball? Until the service starts." It takes me a second to remember that tomorrow's Easter. "At midnight?" I ask. She nods. "Kelly and the others are worried about turnout at the chapel." Almost on cue, we make another turn on the floor, and Kelly Danner passes into view, pointing her index finger at a sophomore in a flashy tux vest, the body language of a witch changing a prince into a toad. All-powerful Kelly Danner, the woman not even Gil trifles with. "They're making everyone go," I say, thinking even Kelly would be hard-pressed to manage that. Katie shakes her head. "They're closing the club and suggesting that people go." There's an edge to her voice when she talks about Kelly, so I decide not to press. Watching the couples around us, I can't help but think about Paul, who always seemed alone here. Just then, the rhythm of the entire party is thrown off when one final couple arrives at the door, late enough to upstage everyone else. It's Parker Hassett and his date. True to his word, Parker has dyed his hair brown, parted it rigidly down the left side, and donned an inaugural-style tuxedo with white vest and white tie for a strangely convincing resemblance to John Kennedy. His partner, the always dramatic Veronica Terry, has also come as billed, in a windswept platinum hairdo, candy apple lipstick, and a dress that billows even without a subway grate to blow it skyward. She is the spitting image of Marilyn Monroe. The costume ball has begun. In a room full of pretenders, these two take the crown. The reception Parker gets, though, is deadly. Silence falls over the room. From stray corners comes hissing. When Gil, from the landing of the second floor, is the only one able to quiet the crowd, I sense that the honor of arriving last was supposed to have been his, and that Parker has shown up the president at the president's own ball. At Gil's insistence, the climate in the room slowly cools. Parker makes a quick detour in the direction of the bar, then brings Veronica Terry and his glasses of wine, one in each hand, toward the dance floor. When he approaches, there's a swagger in his step. It never registers in his expression that he's already the least popular person in the room. Once he comes close enough, I realize how he pulls it off. He's traveling in a cloud of cocktail fumes, already drunk. Katie edges a shade closer to me as he nears, but I make nothing of it until I notice the look that passes between them. Parker gives her a meaningful stare, snide and sexual and assertive all at once, and Katie tugs at my hand, pulling me away from the dance floor. "What was that all about?" I ask when we're out of earshot. The band is playing Marvin Gaye, guitars licking, drums thumping, the leitmotif of Parker's arrival. John Kennedy is grinding with Marilyn Monroe, the strange spectacle of history humping, and all the other couples have given them a wide berth, the quarantine of social lepers. Katie looks upset. All the magic of our dancing has evaporated. "That prick," she says. "What did he do?" Then, all at once, it comes out. The story I wasn't around to hear, the one she hadn't intended to tell me until later. "Parker tried to third floor me at Bicker. He said he'd blackball me unless I gave him a lap dance. Now he thinks it's a joke." We're standing in the middle of the main hall, close enough to the dance floor to see Parker with his hands on Veronica's hips. "That son of a bitch! What'd you do about it?" "I told Gil." When she speaks his name, her eyes travel to the stairs where Gil is making conversation with two juniors. "That's all?" I expect her to invoke Donald's name, to remind me where I should have been, but she doesn't. "Yes," is all she says. "He kicked Parker out of Bicker." I know she means I should let this go, that this wasn't how she wanted me to find out. She's been through enough already, but my temperature is rising. "I'm going to say something to Parker," I tell her. Katie looks at me sharply. "No, Tom, not tonight." "He can't just act..." "Look," she says, cutting me off. "Forget about it. We're not going to let him ruin our night together." "I was only trying to..." She puts a finger over my lips. "I know. Let's go somewhere else." She looks around, but there are tuxedos in every direction. Conversations and wine glasses and men with silver trays. This is the magic of Ivy. We're never alone. "Maybe we can use the president's room," I say. She nods. "I'll ask Gil." I notice the trust in her voice when she says his name. Gil's been decent to her, better than decent, probably without ever meaning to. She came to him about Parker when I was nowhere to be found. He's the first person she thinks of now for something small. Maybe it's meaningful to her that they talk over breakfast, even if he almost forgets it. Gil has been a big brother to her, the way he was to me freshman year. Anything good enough for him is good enough for us both. "No problem," he says to her. "There won't be anyone in there." So I follow Katie downstairs, watching the shifts in her musculature beneath the gown, the way her legs move, the tightness of her hips. When the lights go on, I see the room where Paul and I worked so many nights. The place is unchanged, untouched by preparations for the ball, a geography of notes and drawings and books piled into mountain ranges that thread through the room, as tall in places as we are. "It's not as hot in here," I say, searching for something to tell her. They seem to have turned down the thermostat in the rest of the building to keep the first floor from overheating. Katie looks around. Paul's notes are taped to the shoulders of the fireplace. His diagrams feather the walls. We are surrounded by Kelowna. "Maybe we shouldn't be in here," she says. I can't tell if she's worried that we'll intrude on something of Paul's or that Paul will intrude on something of ours. The longer we stand, sizing up the room, the more I can feel a distance forming between us. This is not the place for what we need. "Have you ever heard of Schrödinger's cat?" I say finally, because it's the only way I can think to raise what I'm feeling. "In philosophy?" she says. "Anywhere." In my lone physics class, the professor used Schrödinger's cat as an example in wave mechanics, when most of us were too slow for V equals negative E squared over R. An imaginary cat is placed in a locked box with a dose of cyanide, which will be given only if a Geiger counter is triggered. The catch, I think, is that it's impossible to say whether the cat is living or dead before you actually open the box. Until then, probability requires you to say that the box contains equal parts living and dead cat. "Yes," she says. "What about it?" I feel like the cat isn't dead or alive right now, I tell her. It's nothing. Katie puzzles over what I'm getting at. You want to open the box, she says at last, sitting on the table. I nod, propping myself up beside her. The enormous wooden plank accepts us silently. I don't know how to tell her the rest of what I mean, that we, individually, are the scientist on the outside, that we, together, are the cat. Instead of answering, she takes a finger and runs it behind my right temple, tucking my hair behind my ear as if I've said something charming. Maybe she already knows how to solve my riddle. We are bigger than Schrödinger's box, she's saying. Like any good cat, we have 9 lives. Does it ever snow like this in Ohio? She says, consciously changing the subject. Outside, I know, it's begun again, driving down with more power than before, all our winter in this one storm. Not in April, I say. We're side by side on the table, just inches apart. Not in New Hampshire either, she says. Not in April, at least. I accept what she's trying to do, where she's trying to take me. Anywhere but here. I've always wanted to know more about what her life was like at home, what her family did around the dinner table. Upper New England, in my imagination, is the American Alps, mountains at every turn, St. Bernards bearing gifts. My little sister and I used to do this thing in the snow, she says. Mary? She nods. Every year, when the pond near our house would freeze over, we'd go crack holes in the ice. Why? She smiles, beautiful. So the fish could breathe. Members pass across the top of the stairs, little pockets of heat in motion. We'd take the ends of broomsticks, she says, and make holes all the way across the lake, like punching holes in the top of a jar. For fireflies, I say. She nods and takes my hand. The ice skaters used to hate us. My sister used to take me sledding, I tell her. Katie's eyes twinkle. She remembers she's got something on me, that she's a big sister and I'm a little brother. There aren't a lot of big hills in Columbus, I continue, so it was always this one. And they'd drag you up the hill on the sled. Did I tell you this already? That's just what big sisters do. I can't imagine her pulling a sled up a hill. My sisters were as strong as a pack of dogs. Did I ever tell you about Dick Mayfield? I ask her. Who? This guy my sister used to date. What about him? Sarah used to kick me off the phone every time Dick would call. She hears the jab in it. This, too, is what big sisters do. I don't think Dick Mayfield had my number. She smiles, folding her fingers into mine. I can't help thinking of Paul, of the dovetail he made with his hands. Dick had my sister's number, I say. All it took was an old red Camaro with flames traced on the sides. Katie shakes her head disapprovingly. Studley Dick and the Chick Machine, I tell her. I said that one night when he came over, and my mother made me go to bed without dinner. Dick Mayfield, conjured from thin air. He called me Tiny Tom. We went riding in the Camaro once, and he told me a secret. It doesn't matter how small you are. All that matters is the size of the fire in your engine. Mary dated a guy who drove a 64 Mustang, Katie says. I asked her if they were doing anything in the back seat. She said he was too uptight about messing up the car. Sex stories sublimated into car stories. A way to talk about everything without talking about anything at all. My first girlfriend drove a water-damaged VW, I tell her. You'd lie down on the back seat and this smell would come up like sushi. You couldn't do anything back there. She turns to me. Your first girlfriend could drive? I fumble, realizing what I've given away. I was 9, I say, clearing my throat. She was 17. Katie laughs, and a silence follows. Finally, the moment seems to have come. "I told Paul," I say to her. She looks up. "I'm not working on the book anymore." For a while, she doesn't respond. Her hands rise to her shoulders, rubbing them for warmth. I realize, after so many hints, so much contact, that she hasn't gotten over the temperature of the room. "Do you want my jacket?" I ask. She nods. I'm getting goosebumps. It's impossible not to look. Her arms are covered with tiny beads. The curves of her breasts are pale, the skin of a porcelain dancer. "Here," I say, taking off the jacket and placing it across her back. My right arm passes her far shoulder just for a second, but she reaches up, holding it in limbo. With me half crooked around her, waiting, she leans in. The smell of her perfume returns, carried in the bell of her hair. This, at last, is her answer. Katie cocks her head, and I reach inside the jacket, into the dark space where it hangs off her shoulders, placing a hand on the far side of her waist. My fingers stick to the rough fabric of her gown, caught by an unexpected friction, and I find that my hold on her is tight and effortless at the same time. A strand of hair falls in front of her face, but she doesn't brush it back. There's a smudge of lipstick just below her lip, so small that it can only be seen from a tiny distance I'm surprised to find I've reached. Then she's too close to focus on anything at all, and there's warmth over my mouth, lips closing in. Chapter 27. Just as the kiss deepens, I hear the door swing open. I'm about to snap at the intruder when I see it's Paul standing before us. "What's going on?" I say, lurching back. Paul looks around the room, startled. "Vincent was taken back in for questioning," he manages to say. His shock at finding Katie in his room is mirrored by her shock at seeing him here at all. I hope they're putting it to Taft. "When?" "An hour ago, 2 hours. I just spoke to Tom Stone at the Institute." An uncomfortable hitch follows. "Did you find Curry?" I ask, wiping the lipstick off my mouth. But in the pause before he answers, we're silently rehashing our argument about the hypnerotomachia, about the priorities I've set for myself. "I came here to talk to Gil," he says, cutting the conversation short. Katie and I watch him edge along the wall toward the desk, gather up some of his old drawings, the ones of the crypt he's been sketching for months, then disappear through the door as quickly as he came. Papers swirl on the floor in the vortex he leaves behind, shifting in a tiny current by the door. As Katie pushes herself off the table, I think I can read her mind. This book is inescapable. Not all the decisions in the world will make it possible for me to leave it behind. Even here at Ivy, where she thought we could shake it off, the hypnerotomachia is everywhere, on the walls, in the air, breaking in on us when we least expect. But to my surprise, she's only focused on the facts Paul relayed. "Come on," she says with a burst of energy. "I need to find Sam. If they arrest Taft, she'll have to change the headline." Upstairs in the main hall, we find Paul and Gil speaking in a corner. The room seems to have gone quiet at the spectacle of the club recluse making an appearance at such a public event. "Where is she?" Katie asks, speaking to Sam's date. I'm too distracted to hear the answer. For 2 years, I've imagined Paul as the butt of every Ivy joke, the curiosity chained up in the cellar. But now, seniors stand at attention, as if one of the old portraits has come to life. The expression on Paul's face is needful, almost desperate. If he's aware that the whole club is watching him, he gives no sign. I move closer to them, trying to hear, as Paul hands Gil a familiar paper, folded over. The map of Colonna's crypt. When they both turn to leave, the membership watches as Gil exits the main hall. The seniors understand at first. One by one, on tables and railings and old oak walls, the club officers begin to rap their knuckles. Brooks, the vice president, is first, then Carter Simmons, the club treasurer. And finally, from all sides, comes this knocking, tapping, rumbling of goodbye. Parker, still on the dance floor, begins rapping louder than all the rest, hoping one last time to stand out. But it's too late. Gil's exit, like his entrance when we arrived, takes place in precise time, the science of a dance step to be performed only once. As the noise of the crowd finally dies, I follow them up. "We're taking Paul to Taft's house," Gil says when I find them in the officer's room.
"What?"
"There's something he needs to get, a blueprint."
"You're going now?"
"Taft's at the police station," he says, parroting what Paul explained. "Paul needs us to take him." I can see the cogs turning. He wants to help, the same way Charlie did. He wants to disprove what I said in the hospital parking lot. Paul says nothing. I can tell from his expression that this was meant to be a trip he and Gil would make alone. I'm about to explain to Gil that I can't, that he and Paul will have to go without me, when everything becomes more complicated. Katie appears in the doorway.
"What's going on?" she says.
"Nothing," I say. "Let's go back down."
"I couldn't get Sam on the phone," she says, misunderstanding. "She needs to know about Taft. Is it okay if I go to the Prince's office?"
Gil senses his opportunity. "That's fine. Tom's coming with us to the Institute. We can meet back up at the service." Katie is about to agree when the look on my face gives us away.
"Why?" she asks.
Gil simply says, "It's important." For one of the few times in our friendship, his tone suggests the importance he's referring to is much larger than himself.
"Okay,"
she says warily, reaching out to take my hand in hers.
"I'll see you at the chapel."
She's about to add something else when a huge thud comes from below, followed by an explosion of glass. Gil hurries for the stairs. We rush down behind him to find a wide puddle of debris. Blood-colored liquid is seeping in all directions, bringing snags of glass with it. Standing at the center of it all, in a perimeter of space everyone else has evacuated, is Parker Hassett, flushed and fuming. He has just thrown the entire wet bar to the ground, shelves, bottles, and all.
"What the hell's going on?"
Gil demands of a sophomore watching nearby.
"He just went off. Someone called him a dipso and he went crazy."
Veronica Terry is holding up the ruffled skirts of her white dress, now fringed in pink and spattered with wine.
"They've been teasing him all night," she cries.
"For God's sake," Gil demands, "how do you let him get that drunk?"
She looks at him blankly, expecting pity, getting fury. Partygoers nearby whisper to each other, holding back satisfied smiles. Brooks is telling an attendant to raise the bar and restock the shelves from the wine cellar, while Donald Morgan, looking newly presidential, tries to calm Parker amidst the hecklers. From the crowd come coos of lush and drunk and worse. Laughter at the edges of insult. Parker is across the room from me, cut in half a dozen places by the shrapnel of upturned bottles, standing in a great puddle of mixed drinks like a child, mashing out the lees. When he finally turns on Donald, he's full of rage. Katie covers her mouth as it unfolds. Parker lunges at Donald, and the two topple over onto the floor, wrestling at first, then hammering each other with fists. Here is the show everyone's been waiting to see. Parker's comeuppance for a million petty offenses, justice for what he did on the third floor, violence to end 2 years of mounting hatred. A server comes out with a flat-faced mop, creating the spectacle at the fight's edge of a man shoveling liquid. On the hardwood floor, the currents of wine and liquor careen past each other, reflecting off the oak walls, and not a drop is absorbed by anything, not mop nor carpet nor even tuxedo, as the two men continue to fight, a great throb of black arms and legs, an insect trying to right itself before drowning. "Let's go," Gil says, leading us around the brawl that's now someone else's mess. Paul and I follow him, wordless, sloshing through the wake of bourbon and brandy and wine. The roads we travel are thin black stitches on a great white gown. The Saab is sure-footed, even with Gil leaning on the gas and the wind shrieking around us. On Nassau Street, two cars have slammed into each other. Lights flashing, drivers shouting, shadows flickering against a pair of tow trucks on the curb. A proctor emerges from the security kiosk at the north of campus, pink in the haze of safety flares, gesturing to us that the entrance is closed, but Paul is already navigating us away from campus, westward. Gil throws the gear shift into third, then fourth, passing roads in streaks. "Show him the letter," Gil says. Paul pulls something from inside his coat and hands it back to me in the rear seat. "What's this?" The envelope is torn open across the top, but the upper left corner bears the imprint of the Dean of Students. "It was in our mailbox tonight," Gil says. "Mr. Harris, this letter serves to notify you that my office is conducting an investigation into allegations of plagiarism lodged against you by your senior thesis advisor, Dr. Vincent Taft. Due to the nature of the allegations and their effect on your graduation, a special meeting of the Committee on Discipline will convene next week to consider your case and render a decision. Please contact me to arrange a preliminary meeting and to confirm receipt of this letter. Sincerely, Marshall Meadows, Associate Dean of Undergraduate Students." "He knew what he was doing," Paul says when I've finished reading. "Who?" "Vincent. This morning." "Threatening you with the letter?" "He knew he had nothing on me, so he started in on your dad." I can hear it in his voice, the accusation sneaking in. Everything returns to the moment I pushed Taft. "You're the one who ran," I say under my breath. Slush sprays the undercarriage of the car as the suspension dances over a pothole. "I'm the one who called the police, too," he says. "What?" "That's why the police took Vincent in," he says. "I told them I saw Vincent near Dickinson when Bill was shot." "You lied to them." I'm waiting for Gil to react, but he keeps his eyes on the road. Staring at the back of Paul's head, I have the strange sensation of looking at myself from behind, of being inside my father's car again. "Is this it?" Gil says. The houses before us are fashioned in white clapboard. At Taft's address, all windows are unlit. Just beyond them stands the tree line of the Institute woods, its canopy tinseled in white. "He's still at the police station," Paul says, almost to himself. "The lights are off." "Jesus, Paul," I say. "How do you even know the blueprint is here?" "It's the only other place he could have hidden it." Gil doesn't even hear us. Shaken by the sight of Taft's house, he lightens pressure on the brakes, letting us roll in neutral, prepared to go back. Just as his foot begins to engage the clutch, though, Paul yanks the door handle and stumbles out onto the curb. "Damn it!" Gil brings the sob to a halt and gets out. "Paul!" The wind hisses around the door as he opens it, muffling his words. I can see Paul mouth something to us, pointing at the house. He begins hiking toward it in the snow. "Paul!" I get out of the car, trying to keep my voice at a whisper. A light in the neighboring house comes on, but Paul pays no attention. He paces up to Taft's front porch and puts his ear to the door, gently rapping. The wind whips through the columns of the facade, licking puffs of snow from the eaves. The window next door goes black. When Paul gets no answer, he tries to turn the knob, but the lock holds fast. "What do we do?" Gil says, beside him. Paul knocks again, then pulls a ring of keys from his pocket and cradles one into the slot. Putting a shoulder into the wood, he sweeps the door forward. Hinges squeal.
"We can't do this," I say as I walk toward them, trying for some authority. But Paul's already inside, scanning the first floor. Without a word, he's deep into the house.
"Vincent?" comes his voice, feeling out the darkness. "Vincent, are you here?"
The words become distant. I hear feet on a staircase, then nothing.
"Where'd he go?" Gil says, moving toward me.
There's an odd odor in here, distant but strong. The wind comes at our backs, snapping our jackets, making the fingers of Gil's hair twist in the updraft. I turn and shut the door behind us. Gil's cell phone begins to ring. I flip a wall switch, but the room stays dark. My eyes are beginning to adjust. Taft's dining room is in front of me, Baroque furniture and dark walls and claw-legged chairs. At the far end is the foot of a staircase. Gil's phone rings again. He's behind me, calling out Paul's name. The odor intensifies. Three objects sit in a tangle on the credenza by the staircase. A tattered billfold, a set of keys, a pair of eyeglasses. Suddenly, everything comes into focus. I turn back. Answer the phone. By the time he reaches into his pocket, I'm already climbing the stairs.
"Katie?" I can hear him say.
Everything is overlapping shadows. The staircase seems fractured, like darkness through a prism. Gil's voice rises.
"What? Jesus!"
Then he's racing up the stairs, pushing at my back, barking at me to hurry, telling me what I already know.
"Taft's not at the police station. They released him more than an hour ago."
We reach the landing just in time to hear Paul screaming. Gil is pressing me forward, forcing me up toward the sound. Like the shadow of a wave at the moment before impact, it settles over me that we're too late, that it's already happened. Gil pushes past me, moving down a corridor to the right, and I'm aware of myself in flashes, in the gaps between instincts. My legs are in motion. Time is slowing. The world is cycling in a lower gear.
"Oh, God," Paul moans. "Help me."
The walls of the bedroom are shot with moonlight. Paul's voice comes from the bathroom. The smell is here, of fireworks and cap guns, of everything out of place. There's blood on the walls. In the tub is a body. Paul is on his knees, bent over the porcelain rim. Taft is dead. Gil stumbles out of the room, but my eyes trip over the sight. Taft lies on his back in the basin, his gut flattened on top of him. There's a gunshot in his chest and another between his eyes, with a well of blood still seeping across his forehead. When Paul extends a trembling arm, I feel the sudden urge to laugh. The sensation comes, then fades. I feel sleepy, almost drunk. Gil is calling the police. "An emergency," he says, "on Olden Street, at the Institute." His voice is loud against the silence. Paul mumbles the house number, and Gil echoes it into the phone. "Hurry!" Suddenly, Paul raises himself from the floor.
"We need to get out of here."
"What?"
My senses are returning. I put a hand on Paul's shoulder, but he darts into the bedroom, looking everywhere. The space beneath the bed, the crack between the doors of Taft's closet, odd slats in tall bookshelves.
"It's not here," he says.
Then he turns, struck by something else.
"The map," he blurts. "Where's my map?"
Gil looks at me as if this is it, the sign that Paul has lost touch.
"In the lockbox that I..."